The night her father lost everything, Vivienne Ashford was wearing pearls. Real ones. The kind that had been clasped around the necks of Ashford women for four generations. Her mother had worn them at her debut. Her grandmother had worn them to a private dinner with the Queen herself. By morning, they were gone. Not stolen, sold, quietly, quickly, without ceremony, the way everything went in those final weeks. The silver first, then the horses, then the London house with its tall windows and its smell of beeswax and old money. Her father signed paper after paper at a desk that was no longer his, in a study that belonged to creditors he could not look in the eye. Vivienne stood in the doorway and watched him sign. She did not cry. Ashford women did not cry in front of solicitors. But she remembered every face in that room, every smirk behind every hand. Every man who had danced with her at the Pemberton Ball not 6 months ago, now standing in her father's study with a ledger and no apology. She was 23 years old. She had been presented at court. She had shaken hands with the king, a brief, formal moment in a gilded room, but it had happened, and no one could take that from her. What they could take, they had. What remained was this, a carpet bag, a letter of introduction written in a shaking hand, and a position at Cavendish Manor. Governess. She had not told her father what the word cost her to accept. He would not have survived knowing. The carriage that brought her to Cavendish Manor was not the kind she had once traveled in. No crest on the door. No cushioned seat. The driver did not speak and did not help her with her bag when they arrived. He simply stopped the horses, waited for her to climb down on her own, and left before she had taken three steps toward the gate. Vivienne stood at the entrance of Cavendish Manor and looked up. It was a brutal sort of beautiful. Gray stone, wide windows, iron fencing that had not been softened by anything so forgiving as ivy or roses. The grounds were immaculate, not lovingly so, but coldly so, the way a man maintains something he owns rather than something he cherishes. She had heard of the Duke of Cavendish, of course. Everyone had. Edmund Cavendish, 31, unmarried, reportedly brilliant and reportedly impossible. The kind of man that mothers warned their daughters about, not because he was dangerous, but because he was indifferent, and indifference, in Vivienne's experience, caused far more damage than cruelty ever could. She adjusted her bag on her shoulder and walked toward the entrance. She did not reach it. The sound of hooves came from her left, fast, confident, the kind of riding that assumed everyone else would simply move. She stepped aside as the horse came around the side of the house, and the Duke of Cavendish dismounted before it had fully stopped, the way a man does when he has never once considered that the ground might not be ready for him. He was tall, dark coat, no hat, jaw set like a man who had decided his mood for the day and saw no reason to reconsider it. He handed his reins to a stable boy without looking at the boy. Then his eyes swept the drive and landed briefly on Vivienne. Not on her face, on her bag. He reached into his riding gloves, both of them, pulled off in one efficient motion, and held them out toward her. They were caked in mud from the knuckles down. He was already looking away, back toward the house, before she had taken them. Laundry, he said, nothing else. And walked inside. Vivienne stood in the drive holding his gloves. The mud was still warm. She looked down at her hands. These hands had been gloved themselves once. Kid leather, cream-colored, fitted to her fingers by a woman in Bond Street who had called her asterisk a pleasure to dress. These hands had rested on the arm of an earl at the Ashford Winter Gathering, had held a teacup in a palace anteroom, while a lord-in-waiting made polite conversation 3 feet from the King of England. Now they held a duke's dirty gloves. She did not throw them down. She did not cry. She did not allow herself even the small luxury of closing her eyes. She walked toward the servant's entrance, gloves in hand, spine straight, chin level, the way her mother had taught her to enter every room, regardless of what waited inside. The door was opened by a woman of 60 with sharp eyes and a ring of keys at her hip. She looked at Vivienne, then at the gloves, then at Vivienne again. "You must be the new governess," she said. "I'm Mrs. Holt." "Miss Ashford," Vivienne said, "simply that, no title, not anymore." Mrs. Holt studied her for a moment longer than was comfortable. Then she stepped aside to let her in. "The last governess," she said, as she led Vivienne down the corridor, "left without a word, in the middle of the night." She did not elaborate. Vivienne followed her through the narrow hallway, past the smell of coal smoke and boiled linen, and did not ask why. She already understood that Cavendish Manor was the kind of place that answered questions slowly, and only when it was ready. Life below stairs had its own architecture, its own hours, its own hierarchies, its own unspoken rules that everyone seemed to know except the person who had just arrived. Vivienne learned them quickly, not because she had been trained for this, but because she had spent 23 years watching how rooms worked, who held power in them, and how that power moved from person to person when no one was looking. The children were manageable. Two of them, a boy of 9 named Thomas, quiet and watchful, and a girl of 7 named Cecily, who asked too many questions and meant every one of them. They had been through 3 governesses in 18 months. Vivienne did not ask why. She watched Thomas instead, the way he positioned himself near doorways, always with one eye on the hall, and understood that children in uncertain houses develop the same instincts as their adults. She taught them in the mornings. In the afternoons, she was expected to be available for whatever the house required. This was a polite way of saying that Mrs. Holt would find her things to do, and Vivienne would do them without comment. She carried trays. She cataloged linens. She pressed tablecloths in a room that smelled of starch and silence. The Duke she saw at a distance, at the head of the dining table through a briefly opened door, crossing the upper hall in conversation with his steward, never pausing, never looking down toward the servants' level. He moved through Cavendish Manor the way a man moves through a space he has memorized, without curiosity, without appreciation, simply occupying it the way one occupies a coat. He had not looked at her again since the morning of the gloves. She told herself this was a relief. It was on a Thursday, 8 days after her arrival, that it happened. Vivienne had been sent to dust the library, a task that Mrs. Holt assigned with a slightly apologetic tilt of her head, as though she suspected it was beneath the new governess but could not quite articulate why. The library was on the second floor, south-facing, and in the late afternoon it caught the last of the winter light in a way that made Vivienne stop in the doorway for just a moment before remembering herself. It was a serious library, not decorative, not the kind assembled by a man who wanted to appear well-read. These books had been opened. Margins had been marked. Spines were cracked in the particular way that only happens when a book has been read more than once. She worked methodically, shelf by shelf, cloth in hand. She was nearly finished with the third row when a title caught her eye. She recognized it immediately, a volume of Cicero, the same edition her father had kept on his desk for as long as she could remember. She had read it herself at 15, partly out of boredom, and partly to prove to her tutor that she could. She pulled it from the shelf, opened it. The margins were full of notes. Small, precise handwriting, clearly the Duke's, analytical, occasionally impatient, once or twice something that might have been, in another man, almost humorous. She was on the second page when the door opened. She did not startle. She had learned early that startling gave too much away. The Duke stopped when he saw her. His eyes went to the book in her hands with an expression she had not yet seen on his face, not anger, exactly. Something more like the particular displeasure of a man who has found someone in a room he considers entirely his own. "That shelf," he said, is not for staff. Vivienne looked at the book, then at him. I was dusting it, she said. You were reading it. There was no point denying it. She did not try. He crossed the room in four steps and held out his hand for the book. She gave it to him. He glanced at the page she had been on, and something shifted almost imperceptibly in his expression. Can you even read Latin? He said. It was not a genuine question. It was the kind of thing a man says when he has already decided the answer and simply wants the satisfaction of asking. Vivienne reached out and took the book back from his hand. He was too surprised to stop her. She found the passage she wanted, a line she had memorized years ago, sitting at her father's knee while he pretended not to notice her sneaking chapters. She read it aloud, clearly, steadily, without hurry, in the pronunciation her father's tutor had drilled into her as a child. Not a performance, simply a fact. When she finished, she closed the book and held it out to him. The Duke looked at her. He said nothing. He took the book, turned, and left the library without another word. The door clicked shut behind him with the careful precision of a man who will not allow himself to slam it. Vivienne turned back to the shelf. Her hand was perfectly steady. Her heart was considerably less so. She found the note that night. She had been in her room for perhaps an hour, a narrow room at the end of the servants' corridor, with one window that faced the stables and a wardrobe that smelled of someone else's lavender, when she noticed it. A small folded paper slipped beneath the door so quietly she had not heard it. She picked it up, unfolded it. Three words, in that same small, precise handwriting from the margins. Who are you? Vivienne sat on the edge of her bed for a long time, the note in her hand. Then she folded it carefully, placed it in the inside pocket of her carpet bag, and blew out the candle. She did not sleep well. Neither, she suspected, did he. She arrived on a Friday. Vivienne knew before she saw her. The house told her, the way houses always tell those who know how to listen. Extra fires lit in the east wing by 6 in the morning. Mrs. Holt moving through the corridors with a tightness around her mouth that had not been there the day before. Thomas and Cecily sent to the schoolroom earlier than usual and told, firmly, to stay there. Vivienne taught them their French conjugations and said nothing. The carriage came at noon. She heard it from the schoolroom window, not one carriage but two, the second piled with trunks. A great many trunks for a weekend visit. Vivienne did not allow herself to count them. She heard the Duke's voice in the entrance hall below, and then another voice, a woman's. Light, practiced, the kind of voice that had been trained since childhood to carry across a room without ever appearing to try. Lady Portia Vane, the Duke's intended. Vivienne had pieced this together from fragments, a comment from one of the kitchen maids, a letter she had not read but had seen on the hall table, the way Mrs. Holt's expression closed like a shutter whenever the East Wing was mentioned. The engagement had not been formally announced, but in houses like this, the absence of an announcement was itself a kind of announcement. She returned to the French conjugations. She did not meet Lady Portia until the following morning. She was crossing the upper corridor with Cecily's forgotten music book when she turned the corner and found her standing there, tall, pale, dressed in something that had clearly been made for her specifically by someone who charged accordingly. Dark hair. A face that was not quite beautiful but arranged itself so confidently that the distinction hardly mattered. Lady Portia looked at Vivienne with the particular attention of a woman who misses nothing and files everything. You must be the governess, she said. Yes, my lady. Lady Portia tilted her head slightly. Where did you study? It was not the question Vivienne had expected. Most women in Lady Portia's position did not ask governesses where they had studied. They asked how long they had been in service, or whether the children were obedient, or sometimes simply nodded and moved on without asking anything at all. Privately, Vivian said, "As was I," Lady Portia smiled. "It was a very accomplished smile. Your posture is extraordinary for a governess." "I was told to stand straight." "By whom?" "My mother." Lady Portia was quiet for a moment. Her eyes moved over Vivienne with the calm, methodical assessment of a woman who has spent considerable time in drawing rooms, learning to read people faster than they can compose themselves. "I know a lady pretending to be a servant," she said, "when I see one." Vivienne held her gaze. "I'm afraid you're mistaken, my lady." It was not a question. "Quite." Lady Portia studied her for another moment. Then she smiled again, the same smile, but something had shifted behind it. Something that was not warmth and was not quite hostility, but lived in the narrow, dangerous space between the two. "Of course," she said pleasantly, and continued down the corridor. Vivienne did not move until she heard the sound of a door closing at the far end of the hall. Then she allowed herself one slow breath. That evening there was a small dinner, just the Duke, Lady Portia, and a local magistrate and his wife who had been invited with the particular casualness that signals careful planning. Vivienne was not at the table. She ate in the kitchen as usual, listening to the muffled rhythm of conversation drifting down through the ceiling. She was nearly finished when Cecily appeared in the doorway in her nightgown, claiming she could not sleep. Vivienne brought her back upstairs, settled her, sat with her until her breathing slowed. By the time she came back down the corridor, the dinner had ended. The Duke was standing at the window at the end of the hall. He did not hear her at first. He was looking out at the dark grounds with an expression she had not seen before, not the cold indifference she had come to expect, but something quieter. Something that looked, from a distance, almost like exhaustion. Then he turned. For a moment neither of them spoke. The candle she was carrying threw unsteady light across the space between them and made the hallway feel smaller than it was. He looked at her the way he had looked at her in the library, not through her, not past her, but directly at her, with an attention that she suspected he gave very few people, and perhaps did not entirely mean to give her now. "The children are settled," he said finally. "Yes, Your Grace." He nodded, looked back at the window. "Miss Ashford," he said without turning, "the note I sent, I did not expect," he stopped, seemed to decide against whatever he had been about to say. "It was an inappropriate question. You needn't answer it." Vivienne stood very still. "I know," she said quietly. She dipped her head and continued down the corridor. She did not look back, but she heard him, the small sound of him turning from the window, the pause that lasted a breath too long before his footsteps moved in the opposite direction. She was almost at the servant stairs when she heard it. Lady Portia's voice from behind a half-closed door, low, deliberate, shaped for exactly one listener. Vivienne could not make out the words, only the tone, careful and pointed, the way a woman speaks when she is placing something very precisely, like a pin through a butterfly. And then the Duke's voice briefly, and then silence. Vivienne went downstairs. She told herself it was nothing. But she lay awake for a long time, staring at the ceiling of her narrow room, listening to the house settle around her. And she could not quite make herself believe it. The summons came on a Monday morning. Not through Mrs. Holt, not through one of the maids with a quiet knock and an apologetic expression. A footman appeared at the schoolroom door at 9:30, while Vivienne was teaching Thomas his geography, and delivered the message with the blank formality of someone who has been told exactly what to say and nothing more. "His Grace requests Miss Ashford in the study, immediately." Thomas looked up from his map. Cecily stopped drawing. They both watched her with the particular stillness of children who have learned that certain moments in a house require absolute silence. Vivienne closed the atlas. "Continue with the rivers," she said. "I'll know if you haven't." She followed the footman down the corridor and did not allow herself to think about what waited at the end of it. The study was at the front of the house, west-facing, a room she had not been inside before. It was exactly what she would have expected, large desk, leather chairs, the smell of wood smoke and ink and something that might have been brandy from the night before. Maps on one wall, a painting on another that she did not have time to examine properly before the Duke spoke. He was standing behind the desk, not seated, standing, which told her something. Seated men conduct routine business. Men who stand have already made a decision and are delivering it. "Close the door," he said. She did. He looked at her for a moment without speaking, in the way that powerful men sometimes do when they want you to understand that the silence belongs to them, and you are simply waiting inside it. Vivienne waited. She kept her hands still at her sides and her face entirely neutral and thought of nothing, except the middle distance just past his left shoulder. "I have been told," he said, "that you are not who you claim to be." She said nothing. "I was given to understand that you came to this house as a governess, with a letter of introduction, with references." He paused. "I am now told that those references, while not false, were incomplete." Still she said nothing. There was nothing to say that would help her, and a great deal that could make things considerably worse. The Duke's jaw tightened almost imperceptibly. He was a man accustomed to responses, to people filling the silences he left for them, nervously, with too many words. Her silence was doing something to him that she suspected he did not enjoy. "You will understand," he said, with careful control, "that I cannot have someone in my household under false pretenses, particularly in a position of trust with my brother's children." "I have not lied to your children," Vivienne said, "nor to Mrs. Holt, nor to you directly." "You concealed." "I withheld. There is a difference, Your Grace, though I understand it may not feel like one from where you are standing." The words came out quietly without heat. She had not planned them, but she did not take them back. The Duke looked at her. Something moved behind his eyes, not anger, or not only anger. Something that was trying very hard to remain anger and finding it increasingly difficult. "You will pack your things," he said. "I will arrange." The knock at the study door was not tentative. Three sharp raps, the kind that belong to someone who does not knock so much as announce. The Duke's expression shifted, irritation layered over whatever had already been there. He moved to the door and opened it himself rather than waiting. In the corridor stood Lord Sinclair. Vivienne had not seen him in nearly a year. He was older than her father by a decade, broader, with the particular confidence of a man who had spent 30 years moving between palaces and parliaments and had decided somewhere along the way that there was no room he could not enter. He had been her father's closest friend since university. He had danced with her mother at their wedding. He had brought Vivienne a book of French poetry when she turned 16 and told her seriously that every woman should read it before she turned 20. He was also, as of 18 months ago, the King's senior advisor on matters of foreign correspondence. He had clearly been shown to the wrong room by a flustered footman and had simply continued until he found the right one. His eyes swept the study, landed on the Duke, then moved and stopped. The change in his face was immediate and unguarded, the way emotion moves across people who are genuinely surprised before they can compose themselves. "Good God," he said. He stepped past the Duke entirely. "Lady Vivienne Ashford." His voice had changed, warmer, louder, carrying the full weight of recognition and no attempt whatsoever to temper it. "I have not seen you since the palace. You look," He took both her hands and held them and looked at her with something that was half relief and half fury on her behalf. "You look very well, my dear, considering." The considering landed in the room like a stone into still water. Vivienne felt the ripples reach the Duke before she turned to look at him. He had not moved from the doorway. His hand was still on the door handle. His face had done something complicated, several things in rapid succession that he was clearly attempting to arrest before they became legible, and had settled into an expression that was not quite anything she could name. His eyes moved from Lord Sinclair's hands, still holding hers, to her face. She looked back at him. For the first time since she had arrived at Cavendish Manor, she did not arrange her expression into something careful and contained, and designed to take up as little space as possible. She simply looked at him, directly, as an equal looks at an equal, or rather, as a woman who has just been reminded by the warmth of an old friend's hands and the sound of her own title spoken aloud in this house for the first time, exactly who she is. She did not bow her head. Lord Sinclair stayed for 2 hours. He spoke with the Duke in the study for the first of them. Vivienne did not hear the conversation and did not attempt to. She returned to the schoolroom, where Thomas and Cecily had indeed continued with the Rivers, and where she sat at the edge of the window seat and looked out at the gray grounds and thought with great deliberate discipline about nothing at all. In the second hour, Sinclair found her. He sat across from her in the small chair that was really meant for Cecily, and looked at her with the tired, careful look of a man who wants to say a great many things and is trying to decide which of them will actually help. "Your father wrote to me," he said finally. "I know. He didn't tell me you'd taken a position. He doesn't know the details." Sinclair was quiet for a moment. "Vivienne, you could have come to me." "I know that too." "Then why?" "Because I needed to do something myself." She said it without apology, without drama, in the same tone she might use to explain a decision about the children's lesson schedule. "I needed to know that I could." He looked at her for a long time. Then he nodded, not agreement, exactly. More the nod of a man who recognizes something he cannot argue with. "The Duke knows who you are now," he said.
"Yes.
He'll want to speak with you."
"I expect so."
Sinclair leaned forward and patted her hand once, briefly, in the way of a man not given to demonstrations of feeling who is making an exception. "You have more composure than anyone I know," he said, "including several heads of state." Vivienne almost smiled. "My mother would be relieved to hear it." The Duke found her that evening. Not in the schoolroom, not in the servants' corridor. In the garden, she had gone out after supper for 10 minutes of cold air and had stayed longer than intended, walking the gravel path along the south wall in the last gray light, her breath visible in front of her, her mind doing the thing it did when she allowed it to move without direction. She heard his footsteps on the gravel before she saw him, unhurried, deliberate. He fell into step beside her without asking whether she wanted company. She supposed that was still a habit, assuming that the space he entered was his to enter. They walked in silence for a moment, the kind of silence that is not comfortable but is not entirely hostile either, the kind that happens between two people who have run out of positions to take and have not yet agreed on new ones. "Lady Vivienne," he said finally. The title sounded strange in his voice, effortful in a way that she suspected he would not want her to notice. "Miss Ashford is fine," she said. "It has been for some time." Another silence. "Lord Sinclair tells me," the Duke said carefully, "that you were presented at court 2 seasons ago.
"Yes."
"That your father was." "The Earl of Ashford, yes, he was." She kept her voice level. "He is also now a man who signed papers in his own study while strangers watched. Both things are true."
The Duke said nothing. The gravel crunched steadily beneath their feet. "I owe you," he began. "You owe me nothing, Your Grace." She stopped walking and turned to face him. The light was almost gone now, the sky above the garden a deep, fading blue. "You did not know who I was. You treated me as you treat everyone beneath your notice. That is not a debt. That is simply information." He looked at her. His face in the near dark was difficult to read, which she suspected suited him. "I will arrange a carriage for you tomorrow," he said, "and a letter, whatever you need." Vivienne looked at him for a moment longer. Then she nodded, once turned, and walked back toward the house. She was almost at the door when she heard him, very quietly behind her. "Miss Ashford." She stopped, did not turn. "I read Latin," he said, "because my father made me. I never particularly enjoyed it," a pause, "until recently." She stood very still for one breath, two. Then she went inside. Lady Portia came to her room that night. No knock. The door simply opened, and there she was, a candle in one hand, a silk robe over her nightgown, her dark hair loose. She looked around the narrow room with an expression that managed to be both unsurprised and faintly contemptuous. "So," she said, "Lady Vivienne Ashford." "Lady Portia." Portia set her candle on the windowsill and sat in the room's single chair with the ease of a woman who makes herself at home in spaces that aren't hers. She looked at Vivienne on the bed with her book and her carpet bag half-packed against the wall, and something moved across her face that was not quite triumph and not quite pity. "You're leaving tomorrow," she said.
"Yes."
"Good." She said it pleasantly, without cruelty, which was somehow worse than cruelty would have been. "Not because I consider you a threat. I want you to understand that. Edmund will do what is expected of him. He always has." Vivienne said nothing. "But you look at him," Portia continued, "in a way that I find inconvenient, and he looks back." She smoothed a crease from her robe. "Men like Edmund don't look back, not usually." Vivienne closed her book. "Is there something you need, Lady Portia?" Portia stood, took her candle from the windowsill. At the door she paused and glanced back with the expression of a woman delivering a final, carefully considered remark. "He won't come after you," she said. "In case you were wondering, he is not that kind of man." She left the door open behind her. Vivienne reached over and closed it herself. Then she sat in the dark for a long time, her packed bag against the wall, listening to the house breathe around her. And she told herself that Lady Portia was right. She told herself this several times. It did not entirely take. The carriage was arranged for 10 o'clock. Vivienne was ready by 8. She had not slept well, the narrow bed, the cold, the particular restlessness that comes not from too many thoughts but from one thought that keeps returning no matter how many times you set it down. She dressed in the dark, packed the last of her things with the quiet efficiency she had developed over the past weeks, and sat on the edge of the bed until the house began to stir around her. She said goodbye to Thomas and Cecily at 8:30. Thomas shook her hand with the grave formality of a boy trying very hard to be a man about something he did not want to be a man about. Cecily cried, openly and without apology, and pressed a drawing into Vivienne's hands, the two of them in the garden, rendered in Cecily's confident, inaccurate style, both figures considerably rounder than life and holding what appeared to be enormous flowers. Vivienne looked at it for a moment. "I shall keep this," she said, "for a very long time." She meant it. That was the thing about children. They extracted sincerity from you without even trying. She folded the drawing carefully and put it in the inside pocket of her coat, against her chest, and did not allow herself to think about what she was leaving or why or whether it mattered. Mrs. Holt was waiting in the entrance hall. She stood beside Vivienne's trunk with her hands folded and her ring of keys at her hip, and her face arranged in its usual careful neutral. The expression of a woman who has spent decades in other people's houses, learning to feel things invisibly. She did not say goodbye, she said. You left a book in the schoolroom, third shelf. Vivienne had not left a book in the schoolroom. They both knew this. Thank you, Mrs. Holt, she said. The older woman looked at her for a long moment, then quietly so that only Vivienne could hear. He hasn't slept since Sunday, she paused. I've worked in this house for 19 years. I know the sound of it. Vivienne looked at her. The carriage is at 10, she said. Mrs. Holt nodded, said nothing more, moved away toward the kitchens with her keys and her silence and whatever else she carried in that careful, impenetrable way of hers. The Duke was not in the entrance hall at 10. He was not on the drive, not at the window she could see from where the carriage was waiting, the horse patient and gray in the cold morning air, the driver not looking at her. She had not expected him to be. Lady Portia had told her as much, and Lady Portia, whatever else she was not a woman who spoke imprecisely. The footman loaded her trunk. Vivienne stood beside the carriage in her coat and her gloves, her own gloves, old ones, a little worn at the right thumb, and looked up at the front of Cavendish Manor one final time. Gray stone, wide windows, no ivy. She thought about the library, the Latin, the note slipped beneath her door in that small, precise handwriting. She thought about the garden and the near dark, and a man who had walked beside her in silence, and then said something about Latin at the last possible moment, as though it had cost him considerably, and he was not entirely sure why he had paid it. She got into the carriage. The driver clicked his tongue, the horse moved. She did not look back. She had decided this before she sat down and she kept to it, which was harder than she had anticipated and easier than falling apart would have been, so she counted it as a moderate success. She was 3 miles down the road when the carriage stopped. Not because of traffic, not because of the road. Because Mrs. Holt had apparently sent a message to the stables, and the stables had apparently relayed it. And what came down the road from behind them at a pace that suggested very little deliberation was a single horse, dark bay, ridden by a man without a hat in 40-degree air. The driver looked back at Vivienne through the small window with an expression that said very clearly that this was not his decision, and he wanted that understood. Vivienne said nothing. The Duke brought his horse alongside the carriage and looked in through the window. His hair was disordered from the ride. His jaw was set. He looked like a man who had made a decision and was already somewhat annoyed at himself for making it, but had passed the point of reversal. "Get out of the carriage," he said. Vivienne looked at him steadily. "I beg your pardon." "Please," the word came out with effort like something pushed through a narrow opening. "Get out of the carriage." "Your Grace, I have something to tell you." He said it with the clipped urgency of a man who has rehearsed something and now cannot remember the order of it. "I have several things to tell you, and I would prefer not to do it through a carriage window like a..." He stopped, seemed to reconsider. "Please." The please again, still effortful, but there which was the thing. Vivienne looked at him for a long moment. The cold air moved between them. The horse shifted its weight. Then she opened the carriage door and stepped down onto the road. They stood on the verge in the thin winter light, the carriage ahead of them and the road empty in both directions, and the Duke of Cavendish told her the truth. Not all of it at once. It came out in pieces, in the slightly disjointed way of a man who is accustomed to precision and is currently failing to achieve it, not from dishonesty, but from the particular difficulty of saying something that has been kept inside long enough that it has lost its original shape. He told her that Lord Sinclair had spoken to him at length the previous day, not just about Vivienne, about her father, about the creditors, about the specific men who had been in that study when the papers were signed, and what those men had done to accelerate the Earl's fall rather than simply observe it. He told her that he recognized two of those names. He told her that they were, in fact, men to whom he had sold debt. 2 years ago, before he had known where those debts would lead or whose door they would eventually reach, that he had not known, that this did not excuse it but that it was true, and she deserved to have true things said to her. He told her this without looking away, which she suspected was not easy for him, and was doing it anyway. Vivienne stood very still and listened. When he finished, she said, "Why are you telling me this?" "Because you would have found out eventually, and I would rather you heard it from me." "That is a practical reason." "Yes," he paused, "there are other reasons." She waited. He looked at her with that direct, effortful attention that she had come to recognize, the look of a man who does not give his full attention easily, and is giving it now, and is not entirely comfortable with what it is making him feel. "You read Latin in my library," he said, "without apology. You held my gloves on your first morning and said nothing. You sat across from Lady Portia and did not flinch." A pause. "You have more dignity in this coat." He seemed to notice for the first time that it was old, slightly worn, not what she would once have worn, than most people I know have in their entire lives. The wind moved across the road between them. Vivienne looked at him. This man who had handed her his dirty gloves without looking at her, who had told her the library was not for staff, who had stood in a doorway deciding her fate while she waited, spine straight, chin level, thinking of nothing except the middle distance past his left shoulder. "You are telling me things," she said carefully, "that require a response I am not yet sure I am willing to give." He nodded, once, as though this was exactly what he had expected and he had come anyway. "I know," he said. She did not get back in the carriage. She also did not go back to the house. Not immediately. They walked the same gravel path along the south wall, the same cold air, the same crunch of frost beneath their feet, except that this time it was morning and the light was pale and clear, and there was no darkness to hide in. He told her about his father, about the estate's finances when he inherited, not ruined but precarious, and the decisions he had made in those first years that he would not make now, about a brother who had died 3 years ago, Thomas and Cecily's father, and how the children had come to him, and how entirely unprepared he had been for two small people who needed things he did not know how to give. She told him about her mother, about the pearls, about standing in the doorway of her father's study watching men with ledgers move through a room that had once smelled of pipe smoke and security, and the particular permanence of a life well established, about deciding in that doorway that she would not be carried by the current of it, that she would move under her own direction even if the only direction available was forward, and the path was undignified, and she had to carry a duke's muddy gloves to walk it. He listened. He did not interrupt. He did not offer solutions or reassurances or any of the things that men offer when they are uncomfortable with feeling and want to convert it quickly into something manageable. He simply listened, which was, she found, more than she had expected from him, more than she had expected from most people. They were back at the house by noon. Mrs. Holt appeared in the entrance hall with the expressionless expression of a woman who has been watching from an upstairs window and will never admit it. Vivienne's trunk was still on the drive. "I'll need my room back," Vivienne said to her. Mrs. Holt's face did not change, but the ring of keys moved at her hip with a small, precise sound that might, in another woman, have been a smile. "It hasn't been touched," she said, and went back to her kitchens. Lady Portia left that afternoon. Vivienne did not see her go. She heard the carriages, again the two of them, the trunks loaded with the same efficiency with which they had arrived, the horses' hooves on the drive precise and final. She was in the schoolroom with Thomas and Cecily, who were doing their arithmetic with an enthusiasm that suggested they had heard more than they were letting on. She kept her eyes on Cecily's sums. But she heard the carriages, and she heard the silence that came after them, which was a different quality of silence than the house had held before, not emptier, exactly. Cleaner. Thomas looked up from his page. "Is Lady Portia coming back?" he asked, in the tone of a child who already knows the answer and is asking to see whether the adults will be honest about it. Vivienne looked at him. "I don't think so," she said. He considered this, nodded, went back to his arithmetic. Cecily, without looking up from her own page, said, "Good." Vivienne did not correct her. That evening, for the first time since she had arrived at Cavendish Manor, she ate at the main table. Not in the dining room, that would have been too much, too fast, and they both seemed to understand this without discussing it. In the small sitting room off the library, where a fire had been lit and two chairs had been arranged beside a low table, and Mrs. Holt had left a tray that was considerably more elaborate than a tray strictly needed to be. They ate and talked and did not talk, in roughly equal measure. At one point, he refilled her glass, and she said thank you, and he said nothing, and the fire made the room smaller and warmer, and more honest than large rooms allow themselves to be. At another point, she asked him about the painting in his study, the one she had not had time to look at properly the morning he had summoned her. He told her it was his grandmother, that she had been, by all accounts, extremely difficult and entirely magnificent, and that he had inherited the painting along with the estate and had never once considered moving it. Vivienne looked at him across the table. "She sounds," she said, "like someone worth knowing." He looked back at her. Something in his face shifted, not dramatically, not the way things shift in moments designed to be remembered. Quietly. The way light changes in a room when a cloud moves. "Yes," he said, "she does." She found the letter 3 days later. She had not been looking for it. She was in the library. She had been given, without formal discussion, tacit permission to use it, which had been conveyed entirely through the fact that the Duke had left the door open one morning and nodded at her when she appeared in the doorway with a book in mind. She was on the second shelf when she found it tucked behind a volume of Virgil, a folded paper, unsealed, with her name on the outside. "Not Miss Ashford. Lady Vivienne." She opened it. It was brief. 4 sentences in that small, precise handwriting she had memorized by now without meaning to. "I have written to your father's solicitor. The matter of the outstanding debt will be resolved by the end of the month. No conditions are attached. This is not offered as restitution for anything done in this house. It is offered because it is right, and because your father deserves to sign papers in his own study without strangers watching." That was all. No signature. He had not signed it, perhaps because signing it would have made it an act of charity, and he had been careful to make it something else. Something that did not require her gratitude. Something that simply was. Vivienne stood in the library for a long time, the letter in her hands, the winter light coming through the south-facing windows the way it did in the late afternoon. Warm and slanted and longer than you expected. Then she folded it, put it in her pocket, and went to find him. She found him in the stables. Not riding, standing beside his horse with a brush in his hand, which surprised her. It was not the kind of thing a duke did, generally. There were people employed specifically so that dukes did not have to stand in stables with brushes. But there he was, coat off despite the cold, sleeves rolled to the elbow, working with the steady, rhythmic focus of a man who comes to this particular place when he needs to think and has perhaps been thinking for some time. He heard her on the straw and turned. She held up the letter. He looked at it, then at her. His expression was careful in the way of a man who has done something he does not wish to be thanked for and is bracing for it regardless. "You weren't meant to find that yet," he said. "When was I meant to find it?" "After you'd left. I thought," he stopped, set the brush down on the stable partition with a small, deliberate movement. "I thought it would be easier to receive if I wasn't here to receive it alongside you." Vivienne looked at him steadily. "That is a very considered way of doing something kind." "It is not kindness. I told you that in the letter." "You told me what it wasn't. You were less clear about what it was." He said nothing. The horse shifted beside him, enormous and patient, and he put a hand briefly on its neck without looking at it. The automatic gesture of a man accustomed to the company of animals who do not require explanation. Vivienne took a breath. "I'm not here to thank you," she said. "I know you don't want that." "Then why are you here?" She looked at him for a moment, at this man in his shirt sleeves in a cold stable, who had handed her his dirty gloves on her first morning without looking at her and had not known, and could not have known, and had spent the weeks since then doing the slow, uncomfortable work of becoming someone who looked, who had walked beside her on a frozen road and told her true things without softening them, who had written 4 sentences about her father and hidden them behind Virgil because he did not want her gratitude and perhaps did not yet know what he did want, or could not say it, or was standing in a stable with a brush in his hand trying to work it out. "I wanted to see your face," she said simply. "When I told you that I know what you did, and that it matters, not as a debt, not as something I owe you, it matters because it tells me something about who you are, and I wanted you to know that I see it." The stable was very quiet. Edmund Cavendish looked at her across the small, cold distance between them, and said nothing for long enough that the silence became its own kind of answer. Then he said, "You should go back inside, it's cold." Vivienne almost smiled. "That is not what you want to say." A long pause. "No," he said, "it isn't." But she did go back inside. Because some things need time to move through a person before they can be spoken, and she had learned in drawing rooms, in her father's study, in a narrow servant's room at the end of a cold corridor, that patience was not the same as passivity. That waiting, done correctly, was its own form of action. She returned to the library. She sat by the window with her Cicero, his Cicero, really, with his marginalia in the columns, and she read and she thought, and she let the afternoon settle around her like snow. 3 days passed. They were careful days. Not cold, not the ice of those early weeks, when she had carried his gloves and eaten in the kitchen and arranged herself to take up as little space as possible. But careful. The way 2 people are careful when something has shifted between them and neither has yet decided what to do about the shift. They talked at dinner, in the small sitting room again, which had quietly become their room without either of them having said so. They talked about the estate, about Thomas's improving French, about a letter he had received from London that required a response he was postponing for reasons he did not fully explain. They talked about her father. He asked questions, real ones, and listened to the answers and did not try to fix anything. Once he laughed. It was at something, she said, a dry observation about a mutual acquaintance, someone they had both apparently encountered at the same Mayfair dinner 3 seasons ago, and remembered with identical reservations. The laugh was brief and slightly surprised, as though it had escaped before he could decide whether to allow it. Vivienne stored it away without appearing to. She was, she realized, collecting him. The laugh, the marginalia, the brushing of his own horse, the 4 unsigned sentences hidden behind Virgil. The way he said her name, Lady Vivienne, with that persistent slight effort, as though he was still getting used to the shape of it and did not entirely mind. She was collecting these things and she knew what it meant, and she was not yet sure whether it was wise, which was perhaps why she was collecting rather than acting. Evidence, she thought. She was gathering evidence. The question was what verdict she intended to reach. On the fourth day, he said the wrong thing. They had been walking the South Garden again, which had become another of their things, another quiet habit that had assembled itself without announcement. The ground was hard with frost, the sky low and gray, and they had been talking about nothing in particular in the comfortable, unhurried way they had developed, and then he said it. "I have been thinking," he said, "about practical matters." Something in his tone made her slow slightly. "What kind of practical matters?" "Your situation," he said it carefully, too carefully, she thought, "your father's circumstances, the question of what comes next for you." Vivienne said nothing, kept walking. "There are options," he continued, "that might resolve several difficulties at once, for your family, for the estate." He paused, "for you." She stopped. He stopped beside her. She turned and looked at him and saw immediately what had happened. She could read it on his face, the particular tightness of a man who has started down a path and is realizing midway through that he has chosen the wrong one but cannot see how to stop. "Are you," she said, very quietly, "about to propose to me for practical reasons?" He opened his mouth. "Because if you are," she continued in the same quiet tone, "I would ask you to stop, right now, before you finish the sentence." He closed his mouth. The frost-hard garden was very still around them. "I have had," Vivienne said, "a great many things taken from me in the past year. My home, my position, the particular safety of knowing exactly who I am in a room." She kept her voice level, but she did not keep it empty. She let him hear the steel in it, and the something beneath the steel that was not anger but was not far from it. "What I have not lost and will not lose is the right to be wanted for something other than the resolution of practical difficulties." He was looking at her, fully, with that complete, uncomfortable attention. "I did not mean," he began. "I know what you meant to mean," she said. "And I know what came out instead. Those are not always the same thing." She turned and walked back toward the house. He did not follow immediately. She heard him behind her on the gravel, a pause, footsteps, another pause, the sound of a man standing in a cold garden deciding something. She did not come down to dinner that evening. She sent a note, brief, civil. A headache cited as the reason, which was not entirely untrue, and ate in her room and stared at the ceiling, and had a long, honest conversation with herself that she did not entirely enjoy. She was not angry at him, or she was, but not in the way that forecloses things. She was angry in the way of a person who has seen someone they have begun to regard highly make a small, revealing error, an error that is not about cruelty but about habit. The habit of a man who has spent his entire life resolving things, fixing things, converting feeling into function because function is something he knows how to manage and feeling, apparently, is not. She thought about Mrs. Holt's voice in the entrance hall. "He hasn't slept since Sunday." She thought about four sentences hidden behind Virgil. She thought about a laugh that escaped before he could decide whether to allow it. She thought about what it costs a person to unlearn 31 years of themselves. She did not excuse what he had said, but she turned it over in her hands for a long time, in the careful way you turn over something fragile to find where the fault line runs, and she thought that she understood it, and understanding it was not nothing. He knocked on the library door the following morning. She was already there, she had been since 7, in the armchair by the window with the Cicero and a cup of tea that had gone cold, more thinking than reading. She heard the knock and said, "Come in," and he did. He looked like a man who had not slept. Mrs. Holt had been right. There was something around his eyes, a density of tiredness that suggested the night had not been kind to him. He stood in the doorway with his hands at his sides and said, "I handled that very badly." Vivienne put the Cicero down. "Yes." "I am not," he stopped, tried again. "I find that I have difficulty with certain another stop." He looked at the ceiling briefly in the manner of a man searching it for assistance, finding none and returning to the task regardless. "I am very good at managing things," he said finally. "I am considerably less skilled at simply wanting something, without attaching a reason to it." The library was quiet. The cold morning light came through the south windows and lay across the floor between them. "What is it that you want?" Vivienne asked. Simply, without making it easy for him and without making it harder than it needed to be. He looked at her. "You," he said, "without the practical reasons, without the estate or the debt or any of it." He said it with the directness of a man who has given up on finding a graceful approach and has simply walked through the wall. "I want you to stay because you want to be here, because it is where you choose to be, not because it resolves anything." The fire crackled in the grate. Vivienne looked at him for a long time. "That," she said carefully, "is considerably better." He exhaled, a short, quiet breath that carried about 3 days of tension with it. "It is not a proposal," he added. "I want to be clear about that." "I know." "I would like the opportunity to," he paused, "to do this correctly, if you are willing." Vivienne was quiet for a moment. She thought about the cottage she had half planned in her mind on the road away from here. The small imagined life, manageable and self-determined, with no one handing her muddy gloves and no one hiding letters behind Latin poets and no one laughing with that brief surprised sound, as though joy was something that occasionally escaped him against his better judgment. She thought about how much smaller that life had seemed with every mile between her and this house. "I am willing," she said, "on one condition." He waited. "The next time you have something to say to me," she said, "say it, without the practical framework around it, without the management of it." She looked at him steadily. "Just say it." He held her gaze. "That is more difficult than you make it sound." "I know," she said, "do it anyway." A long pause. Something moved across his face, not quite a smile, but in the same neighborhood. "Yes," he said, "all right." That evening, they walked in the garden again. The frost was back. The sky had cleared and the stars were very bright and very cold above the bare trees, and their breath made clouds in the dark air between them. He did not take her hand. It was too early for that, and they both understood it, and the understanding itself was a kind of intimacy, the shared recognition of where they were and where they were not yet, and the distance between the two that still needed to be walked. But he walked beside her, close enough that their shoulders were nearly touching, close enough that the warmth of him was perceptible through the cold. And they talked about small things and large things, about Thomas's improving confidence and Cecily's outrageous arithmetic, and a book she wanted to find, and a letter he needed to write, and a dozen other ordinary things that were not, in the walking of them, ordinary at all. At the end of the path, he stopped. He looked at her in the starlight and said, with the slight effortfulness she had come to find not irritating but almost endearing, "I am glad you didn't get back in the carriage." Vivienne looked up at him. "So am I," she said. Lady Portia's letter arrived the following week. Vivienne did not see it first. Mrs. Holt brought it to the Duke at breakfast, and there was a brief, private conversation in the study that Vivienne did not inquire about. But that afternoon, he found her in the schoolroom and told her, without preamble, that Lady Portia had written to release him from any informal understanding between them. That she had done so, he said, with more grace than he had perhaps deserved. That he intended to ensure she was well provided for through channels that did not require her to ask. "She is not a bad person," he said. He seemed to mean it. "No," Vivienne agreed, "she isn't." He nodded, looked at Thomas and Cecily bent over their books, looked at Vivienne. "I wanted you to know," he said, "immediately, not through a letter hidden on a shelf." She looked at him, at the deliberate straightness of this, the care in it. "Thank you," she said. He nodded again and left. Thomas, without looking up from his page, said, "Is His Grace going to be less strange now?" Vivienne considered this seriously. "Somewhat less," she said. Cecily looked up with enormous interest. "How much less?" "Work on your sums, Cecily." London in February was gray and certain of itself, the way London always was in winter, the streets slick with cold rain, the shop fronts lit against the early dark, the particular smell of coal smoke and wet stone that Vivienne had grown up with and had not realized she missed until she stepped out of the hired carriage on Harwick Street and stood for a moment breathing it in. The house she was staying in belonged to an old friend of her mother's, a widow named Mrs. Farron, small and sharp-eyed and entirely unsentimental, who had offered the spare room without conditions and asked no questions, which was exactly the kind of kindness Vivienne had needed and had not known how to ask for. The room was on the second floor, east-facing, with a writing desk beneath the window and a view of the street below and enough quiet in the mornings to think clearly. She had been there 3 weeks. She had left Cavendish Manor on a Tuesday in the second week of January with a packed trunk and a civil farewell and the complete, considered understanding of Edmund Cavendish that she needed time. Not from him specifically. Not from what was growing between them, which was real and which they had both stopped pretending otherwise. But time from the suspended quality of life inside that house. The estate, the children, the narrow room, the library, the garden, the accumulated weight of weeks lived in very close quarters with her own uncertainty. She needed, she had told him, to be somewhere she had chosen, not fled to and not summoned to, chosen. He had listened. He had said nothing for a long moment and then he had said, "How long?" She had said she didn't know. He had said, "All right." Just that, all right. No argument, no negotiation, no conversion of his feelings into a practical framework. Just all right, and then he had helped carry her trunk to the carriage himself, which the footman had found deeply confusing, and he had stood on the drive as she left, and she had looked back this time. She had decided she would allow herself that, and he had been standing very straight in the cold morning air watching the carriage go with an expression that she could not read at that distance, but that she carried with her regardless. London was useful. She visited her father twice a week. He was lodging in two rooms in Bloomsbury, small, slightly damp, with a landlady who overcharged and underheated but who had a garden visible from the front window, and this seemed inexplicably to comfort him. He had aged. Not dramatically, not in the way of illness, but in the way of a man who has had certainty removed from him, and has not yet fully adjusted to its absence. He sat in his chair by the window and talked about old times with a frequency that told her. He was not quite ready to talk about new ones. She did not tell him about Cavendish. Not yet. There was nothing definitive to tell, and her father, in his current state, needed definitive things. He needed facts he could hold. She would give them to him when she had them. Instead, she brought him books and sat with him in the afternoons and let him talk, and sometimes they were quiet together in the companionable way they had always managed even when everything else between them was complicated, and this was enough for now. It was more than enough. It was, she thought, its own kind of restoration, small and unglamorous and entirely necessary. She also, quietly and without announcement, visited a solicitor. Not her father's, a different one, recommended by Lord Sinclair, a precise young man named Mr. Graves who wore very clean cuffs and listened without interrupting and asked exactly the right questions. She spent 2 hours in his office going through her father's affairs with the thoroughness she had been unable to apply when everything was falling, and she had needed simply to survive the falling. She emerged with a clearer picture than she had possessed before, still difficult, but bounded. The debt that had seemed infinite resolved, in Mr. Graves's careful accounting, into something with edges, something that could be worked with. She did not mention that a portion of it had already been settled. That was Edmund's thing to have done, and she would not diminish it by explaining it to people who didn't need to know. She walked home from the solicitor's office in the thin February rain and felt, for the first time in a long time, that the ground beneath her was approximately where she had put her foot. She did not write to him. This was a decision she had made and kept to, though keeping to it was more effortful than she had anticipated. There were things she wanted to tell him, small things mostly, the kind that accumulate in a day and look for somewhere to go. The book she had found in a shop on Charing Cross Road that he would have had opinions about. A thing Thomas had said, relayed in a letter from Mrs. Holt, that had made her laugh in her room alone. The particular quality of London, rain against the window of a room she had chosen, which was different from rain against any other window she had inhabited recently. She did not write these things. She thought them and put them away and went about her days. She was not punishing him. She was not testing him. She was simply doing what she had told him she needed to do, existing in a space that was entirely hers, feeling the shape of her own life without the gravitational pull of his, making sure that what she felt at Cavendish Manor was real, and not simply the effect of proximity and firelight and a man who had, eventually, learned to say things without wrapping them in practicality. She made sure. 3 weeks in, she was quite sure. The letter arrived on a Thursday morning. She knew his handwriting by now. The small, precise hand. She had memorized it from the marginalia, from the four sentences behind Virgil, from the single note slipped beneath her door. She recognized it immediately on the envelope and set it on the desk and looked at it for a moment before opening it. The way you pause before something you have been waiting for without entirely admitting that you have been waiting for it. She opened it. It was longer than she expected. 3 pages, which for Edmund Cavendish was practically a novel. She could tell, from the quality of the writing, more crossed out words than usual, a correction in the margin of the second page, that it had cost him something to write. That it was not the first draft. That there had perhaps been several drafts, discarded, before he had arrived at this one. He told her that Thomas had finally mastered the subjunctive, which he reported with a gravity that told her he understood why this mattered to her. That Cecily had drawn another portrait, this time of the horse, also inaccurate, also magnificent. That the library had been quiet, and that the armchair by the window was the only chair in the house that currently seemed to him correctly positioned. Then he said, "I find that I do not want to tell you to come back. Not because I don't want you here. I think you know that I do, and I think you know that I have stopped being uncomfortable with you knowing it. But you told me you needed to be somewhere you had chosen, and I find that I care more about that than I care about the alternative. So I will not tell you to come back. I will tell you instead what is true, which is that this house is different when you are in it. Not larger or warmer or more manageable, I am aware those would be practical reasons and you have made your feelings about those clear. Simply different, in the way that a room is different when a window is open. Not better, precisely. More itself. I will also tell you that I have been practicing saying things without the framework around them, as you instructed. I have been doing it in private, which I recognize is somewhat beside the point, but I am working up to it. Take the time you need. I mean this without condition or time limit. I am, as it turns out, capable of waiting. I did not know this about myself until recently. Oh, I see. P.S. I found another note in the margin of the Cicero this morning, in a different hand than mine. 3 words in the ablative, technically correct, mildly insubordinate. I have left it there. Vivienne sat at the writing desk in the gray February light with the letter in her hands and read it twice. Then a third time, the postscript. She knew which note he meant. She had written it in the margin of the third page, very small, on an afternoon in the library when he had been insufferable about something. She could no longer remember what, and she had lacked any other available outlet. She had half forgotten it was there. She sat for a long time looking at the street below the window. The rain had stopped. A woman was walking a small dog with enormous dignity. A boy was selling something from a cart, his voice carrying up through the glass. Then Vivienne opened the desk drawer, took out a sheet of paper, uncapped the ink. She wrote. The ablative was deliberate. The insubordination was also deliberate. I will be on the Tuesday coach. She folded it, addressed it, set it on the corner of the desk to be posted. Then she sat back in her chair and looked at the ceiling and felt something that was not complicated and not frightened and not careful. Something that was, in fact, quite simple, the feeling of a decision that has been made and is right and requires no further examination. She had chosen Cavendish Manor, not because she had nowhere else to go, not to resolve anything, not as the lesser of difficulties. Because it was where he was. And because she had missed, with a specificity that surprised her, an armchair by a south-facing window and two children with their father's watchful eyes, and a woman with a ring of keys who never said more than was necessary and never needed to. And because she had missed him, his marginalia and his silences and his effortful pleases and his laugh that escaped before he could decide whether to allow it. She had missed all of it. And knowing that, feeling the full, clear weight of it in a room she had chosen, with no firelight and no proximity and no gravitational pull, except her own honest feeling, was the most certain she had been of anything in a very long time. She told her father on Sunday. She had thought about how to do it on the walk to Bloomsbury, in the cold air with her breath making clouds, turning the words over and discarding them until she had the right ones. In the end, she sat across from him at his small window with the garden below, and simply said it, plainly, the way she had learned to say things this winter, without the framework around them. She told him about Cavendish, about the gloves and the library and the road and the letter behind Virgil, about a man who was learning, at 31, to say true things without converting them into something manageable, about herself, who had carried a Duke's dirty gloves across a drive with her spine straight and her chin level, and had found, somewhere in the weeks that followed, that she was more herself than she had been in years. Her father listened. He was quiet for a long time after she finished. Then he said, Edmund Cavendish. Yes. His father was at school with me for 2 years. He looked at the window, difficult man, brilliant, assumed the world was arranged for his convenience. A pause. The sun. Also difficult, Vivienne said. Also brilliant, she considered, working on the other part. Her father looked at her. His eyes, which had been tired for so many months, had something in them now that was not quite their old light but was moving in that direction. Are you happy? He said, simply that. Vivienne thought about it honestly, because he deserved honesty, and because the question deserved it. I think I am going to be, she said, which feels at the moment like quite enough. He reached across the small table and patted her hand, once, briefly, in the way of a man not given to demonstrations of feeling who is making an exception. She recognized it, she had seen it before. She turned her hand over and held his. She left for Cavendish Manor on Tuesday. The coach was cold and slow and stopped twice for reasons that were never explained. She shared it with an elderly clergyman who slept the entire way and a young mother with a baby who did not. She sat with her bag on her lap and watched the city thin out into fields and the fields widen into the particular open country of that part of England, bare hedgerows, gray sky, rooks in the elms. She thought about nothing in particular. She watched the land go past and let the movement of the coach settle through her and felt, with increasing clarity and no remaining ambiguity, that she was going in the right direction. The manor appeared in the late afternoon light. Gray stone, wide windows, iron fencing, no ivy, no roses. The carriage stopped at the gate. The driver climbed down. Vivienne opened the door herself before he reached it and stepped out onto the drive. The front door opened before she had taken three steps. Not Mrs. Holt, not a footman. Edmund Cavendish stood in the doorway in his shirt sleeves, no coat, which meant he had been inside and had come immediately, which meant someone had told him the carriage was coming, which meant Mrs. Holt had been watching for it, which meant none of this was remotely surprising, and she was smiling before she had entirely decided to. He walked down the steps toward her. He stopped when they were a few feet apart and looked at her, the full, uncomfortable, entirely complete attention. "You came," he said. "I told you I would." "I know," a pause. "I read your letter several times."
"How many times?"
He considered whether to answer this honestly. She could see him considering it. "More than was strictly necessary," he said. Vivienne looked up at him in the fading afternoon light. At this man who had handed her his dirty gloves without looking at her, and had not known who she was and could not have known, and had spent the months since then becoming, slowly and with considerable difficulty, and without losing the essential quality of himself that made the difficulty worthwhile, someone who looked. "You said you'd been practicing," she said, "saying things without the framework."
"I have."
"In private?"
"Yes."
"That is," she said, still somewhat beside the point. He looked at her. Something moved across his face, not the almost smile, not the carefully managed expression she had catalogued in those early weeks. Something more open than that. Something that had stopped trying to be managed. "I know," he said, "Vivienne, just her name without the title for the first time. I know." He offered her his arm. Not a glove, not a laundry instruction. His arm, offered properly, the way a man offers it to someone he intends to walk beside.
She took it.
They went up the steps together and through the front door of Cavendish Manor, and behind them the driver began unloading the trunk, and somewhere above them on the landing, there was a small thunderous sound that was almost certainly Cecily having been told to wait upstairs and deciding against it. Vivienne looked up. Cecily was at the top of the stairs in her best dress, which she had clearly put on herself, slightly crooked. Beside her, with slightly more composure but considerably less, stood Thomas. "You came back," Cecily announced, "to the entire entrance hall."
"I did," Vivienne said.
"I told Thomas you would." Cecily turned to her brother with the satisfaction of someone who has been right about something for several weeks. "I told him." Thomas, to his credit, did not argue the point. He looked at Vivienne with his father's watchful eyes and something in them that was not quite relief, but was its nearest neighbor. "Welcome back, Miss Ashford," he said, with dignity. Mrs. Holt appeared at the far end of the entrance hall. She took in Vivienne, the Duke's arm, the children on the stairs, the trunk being carried through the door. Her face arranged itself in its usual careful neutral. Then she turned and went back toward her kitchens. The ring of keys at her hip made that small, precise sound. 1 year later. The wedding was small. This had been Vivienne's preference and Edmund had deferred to it without argument, which she had noted and appreciated and filed alongside the other evidence of a man who was, slowly and with occasional backsliding, learning the difference between managing a situation and simply being present in one. The church was the same one she had passed on her first carriage ride to Cavendish Manor, small, stone, set back from the road in a way that suggested it had been there long before the road, and intended to remain long after. The vicar was nervous and spoke too quickly and mispronounced Edmund's middle name, which was Reginald, a fact that Edmund had confided to her one evening with the expression of a man disclosing a long-held wound. She had laughed. He had pretended to be aggrieved. Then he had laughed too, not the brief escaped version, but the real one, unhurried and unguarded, and she had thought, there it is. There is the man inside the Duke. And she had been glad, with a completeness she had not known she was capable of, that she was the person he laughed like that with. Her father sat in the front pew in a new coat that Lord Sinclair had quietly ensured he could afford. He held himself straighter than he had in Bloomsbury. His eyes, when he looked at her coming down the aisle, had found something that had been missing from them for a long time, not the old certainty, which was gone and would not come back and perhaps did not need to. Something better than certainty. Something that had survived the loss of it. Mrs. Farron was there, small and sharp-eyed, wearing a hat of aggressive magnificence that suggested she had been waiting for an occasion to justify it. Lord Sinclair stood near the back and looked, when Vivienne glanced at him, as though he was taking personal credit for the entire proceedings. She supposed he was not entirely wrong, too. Thomas sat very straight and looked at the floor with great concentration during the vows, which was how he managed things that mattered to him. Cecily, beside him, did not look at the floor. Cecily looked at everything, the flowers, the vicar, her uncle at the altar, Vivienne walking toward him, with the wide, cataloging attention of a child who intends to remember all of it. She was wearing flowers in her hair that she had picked herself from the garden that morning. Three of them were already listing to the left. Nobody had the heart to tell her. Edmund looked at Vivienne when she reached him. Not at her dress, though it was the finest thing she had worn in 2 years, pale blue, borrowed from Mrs. Farron's daughter, altered by a woman in the village who had done extraordinary work in 3 days. Not at the small spray of winter flowers she carried. At her. The full, complete, uncomfortable attention. She had stopped finding it uncomfortable some months ago. Now she found it the most honest thing she knew, the proof, offered continually and without fanfare, that she was seen. Not her situation, not her bloodline, not the resolution of practical difficulties. Her. "You look," he said quietly, too quietly for the vicar to hear, "exactly like someone who shook hands with the king." Vivienne looked up at him. "I look," she said, "like someone who is about to tell you to stop talking so the vicar can begin." The corner of his mouth moved. "Yes," he said, "all right." The reception was held at Cavendish Manor. The entrance hall had been opened fully, fires lit in both fireplaces, candles on every surface, the furniture moved to allow for the kind of movement that happens when people are happy and have been fed and are not yet ready to go home. It was not a large gathering, but it was a warm one, which Vivienne had learned was the more important quality. She stood for a moment on the stairs above it all, just a moment, before Edmund found her and before the evening resumed its claim on her attention, and looked down at the room. Lord Sinclair in conversation with her father, both of them laughing at something, her father's laugh restored to its old register. Mrs. Farron accepting champagne from a footman with the air of someone who has entirely earned it. Thomas near the fireplace with a book he had smuggled in, reading with the particular self-possession of a boy who has decided that if no one has explicitly told him not to, it is permitted. Cecily dancing with no partner and no music and absolutely no self-consciousness, her crooked flowers still somehow in her hair. Mrs. Holt moving through it all, directing, adjusting, appearing precisely where she was needed and disappearing precisely when she wasn't. She caught Vivienne's eye from across the room, held it for just a moment. Then she looked away and went back to her work, and the ring of keys at her hip made no sound at all, which Vivienne had learned was Mrs. Holt's version of saying everything. Edmund found her on the stairs. He came and stood beside her and looked down at the room with the expression he had, the one she had first seen at the window the night of Lady Portia's visit, when she had come around the corner and caught him unguarded and seen, beneath the cold indifference, the man who was tired of being it. He wore it differently now. Not tiredness. Ease, or the beginning of it, the tentative, slightly surprised ease of a person discovering that warmth is not, in fact, something to be managed. "Mrs. Holt told me," he said, "that Cecily put the flowers in her own hair at 6 o'clock this morning. I know, I watched her do it from the doorway. She said she wanted to look like you." Vivienne looked at Cecily below, spinning in her own private dance, the flowers triumphantly askew. "She looks better than me," she said. Edmund looked at her sideways. "No," he said, "she doesn't." Vivienne looked back at him. He was not looking at the room anymore. He was looking at her with the expression she had collected first and had never stopped collecting, the expression that had no management in it, no practicality, nothing that could be resolved or converted or filed. Simply what it was. She thought about a morning on a drive, a pair of muddy gloves extended without a glance. About the library and the Latin and a note slipped beneath a door in small, precise handwriting. About a road in winter and 4 unsigned sentences behind Virgil, and an arm offered properly at the top of a set of steps. She thought about a girl in a Bloomsbury room telling her father, "I think I am going to be happy," which feels, at the moment, like quite enough. She had been right. And she had been wrong about one thing, which was the going to be. Because standing here, on these stairs, in this house, in this life that she had walked into through considerable difficulty, and had chosen and kept choosing, she was not going to be. She was. Later, when the guests had gone and the candles had burned low and the children had been carried to bed, Cecily deeply asleep, the flowers finally surrendered to the pillow, Vivienne stood in the library. She had come for no particular reason. Habit, perhaps. The room had been hers in some fundamental way since the afternoon she had read his Cicero aloud in the failing light and watched him leave without his book. She ran her hand along the third shelf, found the Cicero, pulled it out. Opened it to the third page. Her three words were still there, in the ablative, slightly smudged where his finger had evidently traced them. Beside them, in his small, precise hand, added sometime in the past year in ink a slightly different shade. Technically correct, entirely welcome. And beneath that, smaller. Stay. Vivienne stood in the library of Cavendish Manor with the book in her hands and the low fire at her back, and the house quiet around her, her house, her fire, her library, her life, and smiled. Then she put the Cicero back on the shelf, exactly where it belonged. In the morning, the housekeeper's daily ledger recorded the following, in Mrs. Holt's careful hand, under the date and the weather and the household accounts. All present, all well. Three words. Sufficient. Thank you for listening to the story all the way to the end. Please tell us which city you're watching from and what the story made you feel. Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss new stories.